The Unified Command's plan is to put people on board for a more extensive assessment when it is safe to do so.
Shell's drill rig Kulluk is aground near Kodiak. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, two vessels sink near Homer during a Christmas snowstorm.
In the way that the vessel is sitting with another vessel on top of it, it was unsafe for our diver to actually recover the fuel at that point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You have the power to help others when you file online for your PFD. It's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. You can make a real difference and support causes that matter most to you, from feeding the hungry, supporting youth in education, or sustaining the arts. Learn more at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Wells Fargo Bank, and the Matt Sue Health Foundation.
The grounded Shell exploration drilling rig Kulluk appears to be withstanding the elements as it sits grounded on Sitkalitik Island near Kodiak. Officials from the Unified Command say it has remained stable on the sand and gravel beach and no fuel spill has been observed. KMXT's Jay Barrett has more.
The Kulluk is a massive drilling unit designed specifically for operations in Arctic waters. With a diameter of 266 feet and a draft of 41, it can almost be described as a floating island with a drilling platform atop it. It was being towed from Unalaska back to Seattle after spending part of the summer in the Beaufort Sea exploring for oil and gas. When its tug, the Ivik, experienced engine problems in high seas southwest of Kodiak Island on Friday, the Coast Guard cutter Alex Haley and two other private ships, the Nanook and Guardsman, responded. At various times during the four-day storm, hurricane-force winds snapped the tow lines from all four ships, eventually leading to the Kulluk's grounding on New Year's Eve. Commander Shane Montoya, the federal on-scene coordinator, said during a briefing on New Year's Day, the tow ships tried to direct the Kulluk to a position that might minimize the impact to the environment and damage to the rig.
They were just trying to maintain some type of control of the Kulluk, as we knew it was going to be going aground. They gave us an opportunity in which to identify the least amount of impact the grounding would have in that area. And so we were providing the alert, some instructions on attempting to get the Kulluk maneuvered into the bay near where they went aground and in that area to have the least amount of impact and damage to the Kulluk when it did go aground.
The Kulluk carries 136,240 gallons of diesel fuel and over 10,000 gallons of various lubes and oils. No drilling mud is reported to be on board. The area of the grounding on Sitkalitik Island is described as critical habitat for endangered stellar sea lions and the Kitsilich murrelet, and is near a number of salmon streams. Stephen Russell of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says the Unified Command will keep a close eye on the area for several months.
Potential impacts to wildlife, commercial fisheries, subsistence uses, recreational resources will be closely monitored throughout the coming months. The Unified Command is currently working with local residents from the region in determining the potential threats that they may have to this area.
Oil response equipment from Alaska Shadow Corporation was staged on the Kodiak waterfront in preparation for transfer the 75 miles to nearby Old Harbor. Shell's Sean Churchfield says salvage crews are ready to fly out to the Kulluk pending favorable weather.
Unified Command's plan is to put people on board for a more extensive assessment when it is safe to do so. Forward base in Kodiak will also be established to be as effective as possible in our response. And as part of the contingency planning, oil spill response equipment will continue to be moved into the theater. Following the assessment from the salvage personnel, the Unified Command will develop a strategy to salvage the Kulluk. The Unified Command is committed to work closely with local communities and the state to identify any potential sensitivities. There will be an investigation into the cause of this incident once we have the situation under control.
Shell's Susan Child says it may take weeks or months to determine the sequence of mishaps that led to the grounding. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
Former University of Alaska professor and current oil spill response consultant Rick Steiner says the weather the Kulik encountered is typical for the Gulf in winter, and he says the problem is that Shell didn't prepare. In a recent op-ed in the Anchorage Daily News, Steiner pointed out that in response to a 2005 ship grounding in the Aleutians, a coalition of business and environmental interests formed the Shipping Safety Partnership. He says it called for comprehensive safety improvements for Aleutian and Arctic shipping, including continuous ship tracking, ocean rescue tugs, and emergency tow packages. Steiner says the absence of adequate rescue towing capability shows a lack of concern for safety.
They were towing it across the Gulf. They knew they should have had a backup plan. They had no contingency plan for losing the tow in heavy weather. And how, and you know how to reconnect it, what additional tugs would be necessary. And obviously, they didn't think it through. And that's the kind of lack of safety culture that we're very worried about throughout the entire project. I'm sure Shell is worried about it, too. The delegation, I'm sure the state of Alaska is worried about it. All of us should be.
Steiner says the Kulik will be inoperable after grinding over rocks, making it impossible for Shell to drill in Arctic waters in 2014.
Shell's entire 2013 Arctic drilling program is on the rocks along with the Kulik. So unless they could find another substitute rig and get it up to compliance in time, which I doubt is possible. So it's a good time to take a breath, take a long look at this project from top to bottom, make sure if they're going to go forward, they get it right. And then take another look at this in 2014 if they really insist.
Steiner says after a series of mishaps that have plagued Shell's effort to drill an exploration well in the Chukchi Sea, the grounding of the Kulik is the last straw for many concerned organizations. The sinking of two commercial fishing vessels in Jackalof Bay near Homer has local oyster growers concerned about possible environmental effects. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
The incident may have happened as early as December 24th, but wasn't discovered until Christmas Day when a passing vessel noticed two sunken vessels, the FV Leading Lady and the FV Kuprianov, in Jackalof Bay about 12 miles south of Homer. Coast Guard Petty Officer Jonathan Alexander says the Leading Lady is reported to have about 50 gallons of diesel fuel and an unknown quantity of hydraulic oil on board. He says a group made up of members of the Coast Guard and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation traveled to the site of the sinking December 29th to conduct an assessment.
So we went out and assessed it with divers. And the way that the vessel is sitting with another vessel on top of it, it was unsafe for our diver to actually recover the fuel at that point.
Alexander says the 53-foot Leading Lady sank down about 40 feet and is laying on its side on the sea floor. The other vessel, the FV Kuprianov, is directly on top with its bow buried into the wheelhouse of the Leading Lady. He says the Coast Guard is contracted with Global Diving and Salvage to put together a plan to offload the fuel and oil safely. The sinking occurred in the middle of a sensitive area on the fringes of Ketchumak Bay, used primarily for oyster farming. Alexander says a fuel sheen was produced by the event.
We do have reports of sheen. When I was on scene, we did see a sheen. It was about 10 foot by 20 foot, maybe 20 foot by 20 foot, a rainbow sheen next to the vessel, no more than maybe 30 feet from the vessel.
Some residents around Jackalof Bay have reported that the sheen has grown to as large as 100 feet by 100 feet. Oyster grower Margot Reveal told the Homer Tribune that the sheen had spread all the way to the back of the bay on an outgoing tide. Reveal says the sheen is not likely to harm existing oysters, but she is concerned it could be harmful to oyster seeds or spat. Alexander says the wind and currents in the area, plus the fact that the Leading Lady is fully submerged, make it difficult to clean up the sheen. He says no boom has been placed around the vessels at this time. A plan to salvage the rest of the fuel and oil on board the Leading Lady is expected soon.
What equipment we need, what personnel we need, and just a strategy to get to the tanks safely. That's what we're waiting on.
It's not known what exactly caused the vessels to sink, but heavy snow load is suspected. More than 48 inches of snow fell in the area during a large storm that moved through south-central Alaska December 24th and 25th. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new director for the United Fishermen of Alaska.
I really care about this industry, and I think that we provide a lot for the state of Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, welcoming Clare House residents to their new home. Learn more at cssalaska.org.
Alaska's largest commercial fishing group has a new skipper at the wheel. Julianne Curry started today as executive director for the United Fishermen of Alaska. Curry grew up in a fishing family and gained statewide prominence as director of the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association. Curry says she has deep respect and passion for the industry and wanted to continue her advocacy on a larger scale.
I really care about this industry, and I think that we provide a lot for the state of Alaska, and given my background in marketing and my background in commercial fishing, I felt that I would be able to bring some things to the table to help promote the industry that wasn't quite being done at this point in time. So it was good for me to be able to make the change and do something a little bit bigger, and instead of just representing the issues in Southeast Alaska, to represent issues on a statewide level.
The UFA board decided to offer Curry the job at its fall membership meeting in Anchorage. She signed a contract with the group last month. Curry served on the UFA board during her 6 years with the Petersburg Vessel Owners. Curry replaces Mark Vinsel, who started in the post in 2004. He plans to stay on in an administrative role. UFA has 35 member organizations representing fishermen, tender operators, processors, hatcheries, and community development associations across Alaska. UFA has its next meeting February 19th in Juneau. During December's meeting of the Alaska Board of Fisheries turned down an effort to make major changes to the allocation percentages for drifters and set netters in Bristol Bay's massive commercial sockeye fishery. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The members of the Alaska Board of Fisheries traveled to Bristol Bay last month for the Bristol Bay Finfish meeting, where the board considered proposals to change fishing regulations in the bay. There were three proposals that sought to change the established harvest allocations between the gear groups in the bay's massive commercial sockeye fishery. Slim Morstad is the area management biologist for the Naknek-Quijack District, and he noted the Department of Fish and Game had concerns about the proposals to change the gear group allocations in the Ugashik, Igigik, Naknek-Quijack, and Nushagak districts.
The department does have concerns with the large changes in the allocation plan. There are risks of large escapements while fishing only set gillnet gear in any district. During periods of high run entry, both gear groups are often needed to control fish passage.
The first of the proposals considered by the Board of Fish was number 63, put forward by a group of set netters in the Naknek-Quijack District. The proposal sought to increase the set net allocation up to 20% in the Naknek-Quijack, Igigik, and Ugashik districts, while decreasing the set net allocation down to 20% in the Nushagak District. The proposal didn't get any support from the members of the Board of Fish. Bill Brown from Juneau says changing the percentages should only be done if there's a significant problem with the status quo.
And while we heard some discussion that, you know, one group wasn't making as much as they should or they haven't kept up over time, that wasn't, to me, it wasn't convincing. I'm not convinced that we need to make any changes in the allocations, and until I heard otherwise, I won't be able to support these proposals, Mr. Chair.
Currently, the set netters in the Naknek-Quijack District are allocated 16% of the harvest in the district, and last year, the set netters actually pulled in 15%. The set net allocation in the Igigik District is 14%, but in the end, the Igigik set netters hauled in 17% of the harvest. The allocation in the Ugashik District is 10%, and that's what they hauled in last year. Another of the members of the Board of Fish to speak out against changing the gear group allocations was Tom Kluberton from Talkeetna, who says the management structure in place in Bristol Bay is a model for the world.
It took many, many years to arrive at the regime that is functioning here, and it's been widely heralded as working extremely well. as Member Brown pointed out, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to tamper with that without some absolutely compelling reasoning.
After just a few minutes of discussion, the members of the Alaska Board of Fisheries voted 5-0 in opposition to Proposal 63. They then decided to take no action on the other two proposals to change the harvest allocations between the gear groups. The result of the board's action is that the gear allocations will remain unchanged in Bristol Bay until at least the next Board of Fisheries Bristol Bay meeting, which will be held in December of 2015. The next meeting of the Board of Fish will be January the 15th through the 20th in Anchorage. During that meeting, they will consider proposals to change fishing regulations in the Arctic, Yukon, and Kuskokwim regions. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
When legislators soon enter Alaska's Capitol building for the session, they won't have to be concerned about falling debris. Gray lumber hugs the marble columns at the entrance to the Alaska State Capitol to support temporary scaffolding meant to catch anything that might break off the 80-year-old building's facade. And when lawmakers leave next spring, work will begin on the Capitol portico, the first phase of building restoration. As KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports, Juneau Senator Dennis Egan recently won Legislative Council approval for some immediate repairs and a design process for future construction.
It's our capital, for crying out loud.
Senator Dennis Egan is a member of the Joint House and Senate Legislative Council. The Juneau Democrat admits he worried some South Central legislators would try to scuttle the proposal, but in the end, the council approved a $1 million contract to Juneau architectural firm Jensen Yorba Lot for a three-phase project. Next summer's repair of the front entry can't come soon enough.
This needs to happen as soon as possible.
State Capitol Building Manager Don Johnston says he's been documenting areas of deterioration since at least 2006, after a window washer noticed loose pieces of sandstone on exterior ledges.
We would cordon off the area down below, and he would remove those pieces for us.
Johnston says the entrance is the most critical area.
If we're talking life safety issues, there is no worse area.
The crawl space also has water, which has begun to damage the concrete foundation and rust steel reinforcement bars. Egan jokingly calls it
a creek running in the basement.
While it's not that bad, Johnston says, the Capitol building does sit downhill.
There are areas where water kind of trickles and runs through the crawl space to 4th Street.
Johnston has worked in the Capitol building since 1985 and took over as manager in 1997. He supervised a number of interior decorating projects, but nothing structural. So much work needs to be done that it will total millions of dollars, the amount yet to be determined. A Seattle area contractor working with Jensen Yorba Lot has already done an in-depth analysis of the building. Wayne Jensen is the firm's manager for the project.
Goal is to have a cost estimate done early in the session, and that'll be presented to the Legislative Council.
Jensen says first phase portico and foundation repair can be done quickly, beginning as soon as session ends in April. The second phase is exterior renovation, starting with the south wall at the end of the 2014 session. The final phase would take two construction seasons through 2015. A major part of the work is what Jensen calls a seismic retrofit.
Seismic event, the building, I don't think, would fail, but some of the materials could start falling off the building. Brick and some of the stone and some of the terracotta could actually come loose because it's been weakened over the years. The seismic retrofit involves installing concrete shear walls from the foundations all the way up to the roof in certain areas so that the building is more capable of resisting earthquake forces.
And that will lead to the building exterior.
There's an opportunity to restore the exterior walls, windows, brick, terracotta, stone, all the components that comprise the exterior wall assemblies.
The 80-year-old heating system with its corroded steel pipes and cast iron radiators will be replaced with a modern hot water system that's easier to control and maintain.
They needed to be replaced years ago, and now's the time to do it.
The east, west, and north sides of the Capitol will be restored in Phase 3. While the work will disrupt some offices, employees will be able to stay in the building during construction, one of the reasons the project is phased. Jensen says much of Alaska's capital is in pretty bad shape.
Most state capitals are going through this or have gone through this over the years. A lot of them were built in the 17, 18, 1900s, so some of them are pretty old.
Completed in 1931, Alaska's capital was built by the federal government to house the territorial legislature, governor, post office, courts, and other agencies. The building became state property in 1959 at statehood. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Quality Inn and Suites on Spinard, providing lodging for Medicare patients in Anchorage with a 24-hour airport shuttle and a hot continental breakfast. Reservations at 800-221-7550. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Kodiak's Representative Alan Osterman and Senator Gary Stevens are two members of a 20-member Alaska Arctic Policy Commission appointed to address statewide and national Arctic issues in the coming years. KMXT's Brianna Gibbs has more.
The commission's goal is to provide recommendations on state and national Arctic policies in the next few years. Osterman said the United States has an official written Arctic policy, but Alaska does not. As the lone Arctic state, he said it's important that the newly formed commission work toward creating one.
We are the Arctic state for the United States, and we should be the ones driving and leading what that Arctic policy should be. So that is the objective of having the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission, and that is to place us in that position. And the second thing is that there's eight nations, Arctic nations, that created the Arctic Council. And the Arctic Council also rotates its leadership from country to country. And the United States in 2015 picks up the chairmanship and the leadership of the Arctic Council.
Osterman said Iceland is one of those nations and a worldwide leader in Arctic policy. In November, the Institute of the North helped send members of the commission to Iceland to learn more about the country's policies and approaches to renewable resources. In addition to being an Arctic nation, Senator Gary Stevens said the country is a shining example of hydroelectricity and geothermal energy use. He and Osterman went on the trip and said it was a unique opportunity to learn how the government assists in the building of hydroelectric dams, infrastructure that Stevens said Alaska is also looking to invest in. He said geothermal technology is less explored in Alaska, but learning more about Iceland's approach was certainly informative.
In Iceland, you know, they just pump the geothermal, the hot water, about 30 miles from a well that they've had in operation for many years. And that geothermal, that hot water, then courses through homes, heating homes, and sidewalks, and hot tubs, and public swimming pools, and keeping the roads clear. It's just really, they've been very fortunate. And whether that's available to Alaska or not really hasn't been proved yet. There are probably some sites that should work, and I'd like to see that continue to try to develop.
Stephen said the trip was especially important as he and fellow legislators on the commission gear up for the legislative session this January. He said there's much to discuss when it comes to Arctic policy and renewable energy projects in Alaska, and he hopes to bring that information to the table in Juneau.
We won't make all the decisions in the 90 days of this session, obviously, but we need to begin moving forward and begin planning to do these things. I'd like to see us put some funds into trying to explore for geothermal to see if it makes sense for us to actually develop those sites. We need to think about the larger hydro plant in the Anchorage area, the Wautana Dam.
The commission is comprised of 6 senators, 6 representatives, and about a dozen Arctic stakeholders from the private sector. I'm Brianna Gibbs.
The Association of Village Council Presidents Regional Housing Authority in Bethel celebrated the grand opening of its offices recently. For member station KYUK, Trim Nick has more.
When Congress passed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act and the president signed it into law in 2009, the AVCP Regional Housing Authority jumped at the opportunity to access what became known as stimulus funds available to Americans to stimulate the economy. The AVCP Regional Housing Authority received $19 million from the Obama stimulus funds to use within the region. A portion of these funds were used to build a new office building for the Native Nonprofit Regional Housing Authority in Bethel. AVCP Housing Authority President Ron Hoffman.
The Housing Authority has been planning this particular development for a number of years due to the fact that we had experienced significant overcrowding, and we operated under three separate buildings in the community. This would allow us to provide more affordable housing services and better serve the clients.
On Friday, the new AVCP Regional Housing Authority office building opened its doors with a ribbon-cutting grand opening ceremony and house blessing provided by the St. Sophia Russian Orthodox Church. Present for the ribbon cutting were the commissioners for the AVCP Regional Housing Authority. The Housing Authority in Bethel used $5 million of the $19 million granted through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds to build its new facility. The new building was constructed using a local workforce. Ron Hoffman.
This particular project was conducted by First Account. Our people actually built this particular development. We had people from the surrounding villages. They're the ones that actually constructed this facility. I'm very proud of their workmanship and their dedication in getting this project done.
From the federal stimulus funds, AVCP Housing also used $7.3 million to build a 19-unit multiplex facility for private homes in Hooper Bay and $6 million to build three triplexes in Alaknak and four in Chivac. From Bethel, I'm Trimnick.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett and Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Trim Nick in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.